Welcome, everybody. My name is Kent Seaton, co-founder of Athletes Touch with Justin Blaine. Welcome to the Tower of Power podcast that we've got coming at you right now. We're an exclusive community helping former pro and college athletes in the business world get ready to rocket fuel your ship, professionally speaking. I'm here. Justin, go ahead and take it away.
If you like great stories, sports, and success, you're in the right place. Buckle up and join us for a great ride.
What would it be like to be the fastest person in an entire country, or number 6 in the world? Join us as Tasha Danvers shares her story about being a bronze medalist in the 400-meter hurdles in 2008, sharing her story of overcoming injuries and transitioning into life after sports.
I mean, I could go down the list. If you've looked at her Wikipedia page, it's as long as all of ours, I think, combined. We got to know Tasha over the last year. And she came out to Athletes Touch, and she has this amazing energy. She's very humble. I'll let her share most of the story, but I do want to say a couple of highlights. First of all, she was the fastest woman in the UK. Think about that. The fastest woman in the entire, I guess, country. She ran a 52, Tasha, correct me if I'm wrong on Wikipedia here, a 52.89 400 meters. I can't even fathom that. And a 53.84 400 meter hurdles, which seems even more ridiculous. And also won, I believe it was a bronze medal at the 2008 Olympics, her second one. So aside from maybe one or two other people in here, she's probably the only real athlete. So with that, Tasha, the floor is yours. And I will go after you give us your intro and some of your background, I will ask you a series of questions too.
All right. Hey, guys. Good to see everyone. First of all, my background, as Justin mentioned, is track and field. I was recruited to the University of Southern California back in 1996 to run the hurdles. Little did I know, I was actually a sprint hurdler at the time. Little did I know they had plans for me as a four hurdler, which worked out very well because that's actually the event that I got a medal in 2008. My first Olympics was 2000 in Sydney, so it was all like, oh, woo! But it was actually the first time I made an Olympic final. 2004, I had my son, so I missed that one. I got a lot of stick for missing that games. Partly because of the level I was at. I was actually, the year before in 2003, I was number 6 in the world, number 1 in my country. I'm actually the second British athlete to make the Olympic final in the 400-meter hurdles for women, and the first Black, the first Afro-Caribbean. So that was like a big deal. So when I wasn't competing, I just got a lot of pushback, and it was actually quite a rough time. But as you know, us athletes, we don't give up too easily. And I went on and pushed through. I had a really great team of people behind me, professionals, but also family that really supported my journey to go on. And although actually 2008, the Beijing Olympics was probably the worst year of my athletic career, it was actually also the best year because I was able to medal at that games. So that's kind of me in a very bullet-pointed nutshell. So Justin, far away, whatever you want to ask.
All right, I'll start you with a layup. Take us through the similarities and differences from your first Olympics experience to your second one. Was the first one happy to be there and the second one trying to win, or kind of what was that like?
That is a great question, because when it comes to British athletes, I've just got to be honest. So I'll say the athletes that I've been around, they do have, in the past, when I was on the team, the mentality was happy to be there. But that's not how I was wired, partly because at 18, I left the UK and came to USC. And they don't play. You know what I mean? They expect high level performance. So my mentality, and that's kind of who I was as a person anyway, so it just fit right in. So my first Olympics, I'm really looking to make an impact. At the very least, I wanted to run a personal best. So I actually did run a personal best in the final, which put me 8th place, but I'm cool with that, right? You run your best, you can't ask for much more. So we had 3 of us that actually were qualified for the Olympic Games. Out of the 3, I was the only person that made it out of the heats and into the final. And I'll tell you the reason why. I was actually observing the other girls that were in my event, the other girls on the UK team. And I noticed that because they were at the Olympic Games, it's like they threw all their previous training and mindset and process out the window. They're like overwhelmed. And the thing is, I had already been working on how I was going to handle the Olympics mentally before I ever got there. I'd had an opportunity to speak to Sally Gunnell, who is the gold medalist from 1992, the only other British female athlete that's gotten a medal in that event in my country. And she said to me one day, she said, I used to rehearse my race in every single lane at least twice a day. And she said, I would picture myself being passed. I would picture myself being in the back. I'd picture myself being in the front, but I'd always win. So she said, by the time she got to the 1992 Barcelona Olympics, she felt like she belonged there, like she had already been there. It wasn't unfamiliar to her. And I took that to heart. So I used to practice and rehearse. So when I got to the Olympics, I was, before I got there, I was just like, ah, yeah, whatever. It's, you know, just another race. One lap around the track, 10 hurdles, who cares? Like, that's literally how I had it in my head. Needless to say, when we walked through that tunnel, and Sydney was one of the largest stands, like the biggest amount of crowd. So it's, and the finals are always at night and they're all bunched together. So there's a lot of like energy and hype. But that first round, even that first round, I'm coming through this tunnel and I still got that kind of, you know, cool, chill, got nothing to lose, everything to gain, right? So I'm that attitude. And you walk out into this tunnel because it's like quite enclosed. You can't see. You come out into this tunnel and it's 110,000 people so far, your eyes cannot make them out, just going nuts, like for whatever's going on at the track at the time. And I was like, oh, that old Olympic spirit thing they talk about, it's actually real. Like, I didn't really believe in that. But when I got there, I realized the Olympic spirit was so real. And because I had that attitude, that allowed me to perform, I think, a bit better than the other ladies that were there. Now, put that against 2008. So that was my first one. Not bad, not too shabby, as we say in the UK. Now, 2008, it's been 8 years now since I have competed at the Olympic Games, because remember, I had my son during the Athens Games. So this like really, really means a lot to me. The problem was, so I was getting to that point of the season where it's, okay, it's time to go now. I start trying to compete and it just, nothing was going right. My Achilles was just inflaming. It just would not settle down. And it got to the point where in training, I couldn't even go 50 meters. Now, I'm a 400 hurdler. I'm going to need another 350 a couple times to get this job done. So I'm like in a panic now. And I call up the UK and I'm like, hey, listen. So they treat me and everything's fine. I go back out onto the track and I pull my hamstring. And this stuff like this was just going on all year. But again, we have that athlete mentality where we just can't give up. And so I went into my 2008 Olympic trials and I'd had a ridiculously pathetic year. Like on paper, I wouldn't have even taken me. But again, we don't give up, right? So I'd been working with the doctors trying to get things on track and get to the heat of my race. And I'm feeling good. And I get out there, win my heat. I'm like, okay, sign me up. We going to the Olympics, girl. Right? So we get out there for the final. And I'm jazzed because I feel like I've got this in the bag. And so I get out there and I'm ready. The gun goes off, boom. I'm running down that, round that turn, down that back straight, just moving. I'm feeling good. I'm starting to put the pressure on as we're coming into that last 100 meters. And so I'm trying to put on gear 6 and nothing's happening. And there's another girl, she's coming up. Of course, she's on my inside, which is like the worst place you want your highest contender in a hurdles race. So she starts coming up and I can hear her footsteps. And this chick just flies by me like I am standing still. And I'm just like bawling my eyes out. Right? The reason why that was the case at that time is because, number one, it had been 8 years. Number two, my son was about 3 or 4 at this time. And I wanted him to feel when he grew up that he wasn't the reason why things didn't happen for me. And I also knew that the way that the rules worked, they couldn't take both of us. The way that the Olympic standards work in track and field is they have what's called an A standard and a B standard. Now, that time frame is from a 12-month period. So I actually had the A standard, the highest standard from the previous year, but I hadn't run that standard in that current year in 2008. The other girl, on the other hand, she had the B standard from this year. So she's like actually really doing stuff right now. So that was really devastating for me because I felt like, man, I had worked my butt off for 8 years as a mother, trying to hustle with working and training. And like, I just could not believe that this was the reality. So after I put my actual athlete brain back in my head, I just started to say, well, what do I have control over? I have control over how I think right now and how I act. Yes, I don't have control over whether they choose her or me, but I can control how I'm processing this whole thing. So I gave myself, you know, a couple of minutes, and then I just got back to it. And I started to visualize myself crossing the line at the Olympic Games, pointing up to my coach. I would just repeat that over and over. And it's a 7-day process while they decide who's going to be on the team. And after 7 days, the management called me up and basically said they picked me. And part of that reason is because really didn't make sense on paper. But the reason was because that in previous years, no matter what the challenge was, I somehow would always rise to the occasion. So they put that out in the press, who was on the team. And within 1 hour, the head coach of the Olympic team got 42 texts asking, why on earth did you put Tasha on that team? With that in context now, you can see my whole going to 2000 was like completely unknown. 2008 was like, I'd been there, but I'd had some challenges. I still kind of didn't know how I would perform. So because I still had little injuries and little things going on, I really didn't know how I would do. So that first heat, I said, okay, if I can get off a good time in this, I'm good to go. So I ran that first heat. I ran a good time. And basically, the rest was history. By the time I got to the final, I just felt like I had everything to gain and nothing to lose. So the difference was basically coming as an amateur, really not understanding the power of mindset. And then 2008, using all everything I'd learned in those 8 years to channel everything that I had into that moment. It was about a tenth of a second between myself and silver, so I could have pushed a little harder out the blocks. I don't know. So that's kind of the long version of the answer to your question.
Welcome to the intermission. Kent, who's this group for? Is it for Super Bowl champs?
Check.
How about cross-country skiers?
Check.
How about Olympic synchronized swimmers?
Triple check.
So it sounds like anybody who has an athlete's mindset or mentality could qualify here.
Quadruple check, Justin. This group is a rocket fuel powered community for former athletes to use their state of mind to succeed in the sport of business.
That was great. So, okay, what was it like standing up on the podium? And even more so, what was it like the next day?
You know, it's really surreal, the whole process after, because you get your medal the next day at the podium, but this thing has happened. Even when I called my dad, I was in drug testing right after the race. I called my dad and I'm like, my dad's Jamaican, so is my mom. So I'm like, dad, did you see my race? And he's like, yes, but did you see Usain Bolt? I'm like, what? I mean, yeah, but you know, what about me, right? So afterwards, it's like very like surreal. Lots of press obviously want to speak to you. Because I was such an unexpected medal, it was like a big deal. So that was awesome. And then I can't even remember being on the podium, really. I don't remember anything. The only reason why I know it happened is because there's pictures online of it. But I know the whole feeling. I know the feeling of it. I don't remember it, but it was very surreal. It's a very surreal feeling to be on the Olympic podium because the stadium is packed and it's night and the lights and
so mention sure. Your son, and I think you and I have talked about this before. You have a teenager son who is now running track, right?
Yes.
So talk about that, what it's like to have an Olympic mom. I guess I should ask him that. But like, how do you teach or coach or share nuggets of being as good as you were without, while giving him the space to flourish in his own right? Like, how do you balance that? What do you do when it comes to track and field with your son?
You know, it's so nuts because my son is Mr. Cool Breeze, which is weird because I'm completely nuts. So to see him, you know, like, I've never had to say to him, you know, keep your confidence. He's just so relaxed. And at first I would try to say, you know, do this, do that. But I sensed a little pushback. So I kind of just leave him to it. If I hear something that really stands out to me that I feel like I need to address, I'll ask questions to kind of explore his mind. So like, but as far as interjecting and coaching him, his dad was also an athlete at UCLA, ran track. So I kind of leave them, do the boy stuff. I did the young kid stuff, rolling down the hill at Kenneth Hunt Park and that stuff. Now he's a bit more like into video games and I'm like lost with that stuff. So I really just, if he comes to me and he asks for my help, I will more than happy. But as a teenage boy, I kind of leave into it and just cheer him on.
Okay. All right, I'm going to shift gears. And I noticed that you had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. How did that come to be? Why did you do that? Were you crazy? Were you just trying to find something else to conquer? What was the thought process there? Now, it sounds like you retired 7 or 8 years ago. What was the transition like from being number one in the world, number three at an Olympics, everyone celebrating you, climbing Kilimanjaro, so, okay, now I got to join the real business game. What was that like?
You know, sometimes I feel like I'm still transitioning because I really lived in a athletic bubble. I was probably 13 when I started sports, but I was 15 when I first started competing internationally. So by the time I retired at 35 in 2012, right? I was 35 years old. So I'd been 20 years of just sport. That's all I knew. So to go outside of this bubble was very unfamiliar to me. I'd never really done anything else. And even if I did, it was always something sports related. So like I'm an ambassador for Jaguar Motor Company, or I'm, you know, doing sports ambassadorships for the city, or I wasn't working on any business myself. Now, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, maybe I should be starting my own stuff, right? Because this bubble is not going to last forever. But when you're in the track and field world, or any sports for that matter, the mindset of thinking that this is going to end is kind of like contrary to what you want to believe, because that's almost as if saying your achievement level that you're expecting is not going to happen. I still feel like I have a lot to learn to actually transition. I know that I'm probably being hard on myself. I was not a relationship person. Throughout my whole career, I was exactly the issue that Athletes Touch talks about. I was just focused on sport. I probably met so many people that had I nurtured those relationships, we could be doing phenomenal things right now, but I can't even remember their names now. And I feel that I really missed a huge opportunity, because now that I understand the world outside sports properly, I'm like, oh, I wish I could call so-and-so, but they're gone, they're lost in the wind now. So I think that's really the biggest thing that I've noticed, is just the things I should have done, right? Nurturing those relationships. I've traveled the world and couldn't tell you anything about half the places or all the people I met there, and that is a crying shame. But now I'm getting to know you.
That's right. Well, so touch on that a little bit more. So I know you do some kind of mentoring and some coaching as, you know, throughout your journey. Are those some of the lessons that you teach, whether it's other athletes, other people you come across? What are a couple of the main focal points for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my main things are just, like you said, the similarities between sports, the similarities between business. Basically, success, it has a blueprint. We don't really need to reinvent the wheel. So a lot of what I focus on is purpose. We can see that doesn't matter whether you're in business, doesn't matter whether you're a sports person, doesn't matter whether you're a mother. It's the purpose that's going to drive you to do it. So when I'm working with people, I'm looking at, okay, let's get to the bottom of what's your purpose. And not just for others, also for yourself. We layer it, you have a nice balance. So when I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, the purpose was to serve them, but I also wanted to do it so I could say, Tasha, well done, you did that. Even with sports, when I was just doing it for me, it didn't work for me. In 2003, I was number one in my country, like I said, and number six in the world. And I wanted to quit. I did not want to do the sport. And people are like, what's wrong with you? You're doing so well. I didn't see the purpose. I don't care about like having a bunch of medals or trophies in my cabinet. I didn't find any purpose behind it. But I realized the higher you get in whatever field you're in, the more of a platform you have. I don't think I really got that before. So now for purpose, I had a purpose for myself to get to, you know, to say, Tasha, you can do this. But now I had a purpose for others because I realized the higher I could get, the more of a platform I could create to then inspire others to go after their dreams as well. Now that's a reason I can compete for. So I work with people on purpose. Accountability, I think, is huge. I think it's one of the secrets that people don't really take advantage of. They use their own accountability. It's like, I got this, I'm gonna do this. And I can say 100%, and most of the athletes here will say, without their coach, it wouldn't have happened. But then they don't take that into other areas of their lives, like business and things like that. So accountability, purpose, and mindset. Those are my three that I really, really love to focus on with people.
I like it. All right, Tasha, I'm going to open it up for a couple more questions. Let's see. Okay, Chad.
Awesome. Thanks, Justin. Tasha, yeah, this is great. Really appreciate your informative story. My question is, you mentioned a key word here was mindset. And I would say right now with Michael Jordan and The Last Dance and Kobe Bryant, rest in peace, and his Mamba mentality, was there a specific person, a book, a coach that you leaned on to go through the mental challenges that you faced along your career?
Great question. Thank you so much for asking. I am a lover of learning. I have so much stuff in my head. I don't know where half of it comes from. I know one of the books that really, I'm sure a lot of you have read already, is Think and Grow Rich. You know, as I really started to understand more about the quantum field and things like that. So I study a lot with Dr. Joe Dispenza, studying his stuff, and really, truly, especially now that there's so much more evidence, science-based evidence on how the mind works, to really take advantage of how your mind can impact. See, what happens with a lot of us is that we're functioning in our conscious mind most of the time. Unfortunately, you know, most of our actions are based on 95 to 99% of subconscious behaviors. So we're almost on autopilot most of the time. So the study really is to ask ourselves, how can I access my subconscious mind so I can change my programming to achieve what it is I want to achieve? Now, some of us do that through conscious programming because we are positive in that sense. So we'll say positive affirmations. We are constantly self-talking ourselves positively. So it kind of gives us that programming that comes naturally and bleeds into the subconscious mind. But there's so much more we can do because the conscious is only 10 to 5% of the entire game. As far as people that I would look up to, I mean, I love the way Muhammad Ali handled his whole. So people like that inspired me because they're just so strong that it would never take no for an answer in terms of their performance. So even in life in general, that's the kind of attitude I want to take. But I work really hard to program myself because our minds are like computers, and it's an awful waste not to really get deeper into studying how the mind actually works, because we can do absolutely phenomenal things if we could tap into our subconscious programming. So that's kind of my mindset. And if I look back throughout my career, it is very evident. Whenever I had a poor mindset, shortly after, my performances would reflect it. Whenever I had a poor mindset, when I went into depression, I wasn't looking at the positive things in my life, and it just grew on itself. And so I can look back and say with 100% surety that the times when my mind was in the right place were the times when I was most successful, period, point blank. So mindset, I think, is the biggest thing, because without it, everything else falls flat. So even if you have the best coach, the best advisors, the best books, the best information, if you don't have the right mindset, none of it will grow too much because there's nothing for it to lay upon. So I always like to work there first, figure out what could be holding people back, figure out where they keep bumping up into the same issues. And then once we've built that strong foundation, then we can layer everything else on top.
Another great story in the books. Who's inspired with me? Kent, where do people go from here?
God, Justin, I'm so glad you asked me that question. Everybody today, we're so excited to have you on this show. If you're interested in our Rocket Fuel Accelerator, if you'd like to join membership at Athletes Touch, go to our awesome website at www.athletestouch.co, and we'll see you soon. If you want to look us up on our social handles, LinkedIn and Twitter, Athletes Touch, at Athletes Touch. Thanks, guys.